Good afternoon, everybody. Shul Plotzer coming at you live. It's Monday afternoon. It's May 15th of 23. And we do our book club at 1 o'clock on Mondays. Welcome aboard. We're on page 247, almost done with the book called The Rav, The World of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, Volume 1, by Dr. Aaron Rakefet Rothkopf. We're now going to take a look at the chapter known as Prijana and Razin. Prijana is where Rabbi Elio Feinstein Prijana came from, Prijana. And Razin is the town also out there. We're going to get a little more detail about that soon enough. Here's a beautiful story by Rabbi Soloveitchik about his father and how his father taught his students and the impact that it had on a little child. If there's anybody in this house who'd like to hear an incredible story, you are welcome to come and hear it right here. So come a running. You don't want to miss this one. The concept of Talmidia, of tradition, the concept of tradition related by Rabbi Soloveitchik in his essay, will be Kashta Misham, she wrote in Hebrew. He writes, let me stress the idea of the Masorah by telling you a personal story. I remember that when I was growing up, I was a frightened and lonely boy. I was afraid of the world. For me, the world was a cold and strange place. I imagined that everyone was mocking me. But I had one friend. Do not laugh at me. It was the Rambam, Maimonides. How did we become friends? Simply, we met. Maimonides was a constant guest in our home. During the days when my father was a newlywed, supported by my grandfather, the pious Gaon, Rabbi Elijah Feinstein of Prijana, Daddy studied Torah day and night. A small group of outstanding young scholars gathered around him and eagerly absorbed his teachings. My father studied with his disciples in the room where my bed was located. My wont was to sit on my bed and listen to my father's words. He constantly quoted Maimonides. His method was to first open the Talmud and analyze the text under discussion and the relevant commentaries. He would generally say, these are the explanations of Rabbi Isaac of Dampierre, known as the Re, who passed at or around 1185 of the Common Era. And these are the explanations of the other Tosafists. Now, let us examine the explanation of Maimonides. Topic 248. My father, this is Rabbi Soloveitchik speaking about Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik, his father. My father would inevitably discover that Maimonides rejected the basic explanation of the text and differed with Tosafists. My father would declare, as if to complain, that we cannot comprehend the approach and conclusion of Maimonides toward the Talmudical text. It was almost as if my father were directly saying to Maimonides, Rabbeinu Moshe, why have you taken this approach? My father would continue. At first glance, the Ravid, Rabbi Abraham ben David of Poskier, who was born at around 1125 and passed at around 1125 to 1198. At first glance, the Ravid is correct in his criticism of the Mishnah Torah, which is, of course, the magnum opus of Maimonides. The students would jump forward and each would express his thoughts. My father would carefully listen, but would refute their proposed interpretations. Once again, he would exclaim that the words of Maimonides were incomprehensible. Nevertheless, my father would not give up. He would place his head on his hand and soon be engrossed in deep thought. The students would not disturb his thought process. Finally, my father would gradually lift his head and begin to expound the true meaning of Maimonides. Sometimes he would be lengthy, and on other occasions, brief. I would strain my ears to catch my father's every word. In my young and impressionable mind, there developed a dual impression. First, that the Rambam, Maimonides, was being attacked by enemies who wanted to hurt him. And second, that the Rambam's only defender was my father. I felt strongly that without my father, who knows what would have happened to the Rambam. It was as if the Rambam himself were with us in the room, listening to my father's words. The Rambam sat next to me on my bed. What did he look like? I don't know exactly. He seemed to look like an exceedingly handsome and good father. His name was also Moshe, just like my father. Intensely following my father, the students absorbed his every word. Slowly but surely, the tension evaporated. My father continued his discourse with strength and courage. New ideas were clarified. The halachot under discussion were classified and carefully articulated. A new light emerged. The questions were resolved, and the topic properly explained. Maimonides emerged triumphant, and my father's face was filled with happiness and delight. He had defended his friend Rabbeinu Moshe ben Maimon. The Rambam was comforted and smiled. I too was delighted and joined in the feeling of joy in the room. I would jump from my bed and run to my mother and cry out the good news. Mother, mother, the Rambam won. He beat the Ravid. Father helped him. Look how wonderful my father is. Wow, for a child to have that impression. But once in a great while, my father did not succeed. And despite all his efforts, the enemies of the Rambam defeated him. Their questions were as strong as iron. Although my father mustered all his strength, he could not save the Rambam from his detractors. Salvation did not come for the Rambam. Deep in thought, my father would lean his head on the palms of his hands on the table. The students and I, and even the Rambam, waited in great tension for my father's words. But my father would raise his head and sadly state, "There is no answer. The words of the Rambam are difficult. No one is capable of resolving these questions." The shiur ended with no explanation. The students were sad, and even my father was depressed. A sense of despair descended upon all of us. I cried. Even the eyes of the Rambam glistened with teardrops. With a broken heart, I would walk slowly to my mother and cry out to her, "Mother, father cannot answer the Rambam. What will we do? He did not succeed today." And my mother would tell me, "Don't worry. Father will find an answer to the Rambam. If he does not succeed, then when you grow up, perhaps you will find an answer to the Rambam." Always remember, my son, the important thing about Torah is to study it in happiness and enthusiasm. With beautiful words, maybe you'll one day grow up and answer that which your father cannot. What a beautiful sentiment that is. It is true that the story is part of my youth. It is not, however, the fantasy of a young child or the creation of mystical feelings. This story is an historic and psychological reality that guides me at all times. When I sit down to learn, the giants of the Masorah are with me. Our relationship is personal. The Rambam sits to my right, Rabbeinu Tam to my left. Rashi sits at the head and explains. Rabbeinu Tam asks. The Rambam decides the halacha, and the Ravid objects. All of them are with me in my small room, sitting around the table. They look at me with fondness. They work the text out with me. And like a father, they encourage and strengthen me. Learning Torah is not just a didactic, formal, and technical experience whose purpose is the creation and exchange of ideas. Learning Torah is the intense experience of uniting many generations together, the joining of spirit to spirit, and the connecting of soul to soul. Those who transmit the Torah and those who receive the Torah are invited to meet one another at the same historic juncture. Have you ever read anything so beautiful? How beautiful is that? That is superbly beautiful. Page 250, Refuting the Ravid, related by Rabbi Soloveitchik to his Talmud class, when the author was a student at Yeshiva University. But Moshe Soloveitchik's first rabbinical post was in Razein, or Razeinai, Lithuania. The previous rabbi of the city was the highly regarded Rabbi Alexander Moses Lapidot, who had been a student of Yisrael Salanter and had served the community for nearly 40 years. 40 years, 4-0. Excuse me, Rabbi Lapidot, possessing all the traits necessary for such a rabbinate, was also considered a seasoned posek, a decisor of Jewish law. When Reb Moshe stood for the post, some of his fathers, but he really meant my fathers, when Reb Moshe Soloveitchik stood for the post of rabbi, my father's leading students intervened on behalf of his candidacy. Among them was Rabbi Baruch Ber Leibowitz, very famous rabbi in the 1866 to 1939. He boasted about the candidate's prodigious learning and claimed that Rav Moshe was capable of refuting every one of the Rebbe's criticisms of the Mishneh Torah of the Rambam. A leading scholar of Razain evidently felt that such scholarship did not necessarily result in expertise in Psak Halacha. He responded to Rav Baruch Ber and exclaimed, "To resolve the Rebbe's criticisms of the Rambam, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik can remain with his father in Brisk. We need a rabbi here who can be an excellent posek and communal leader." Top page 251. Guidance for Yom Kippur. This is super, super important, super interesting. Related by Rabbi Soloveitchik in his essay, Halachic Man. Quoting the Gemara in Yuma 85b, "The saving of a life overrides the commandments of the entire Torah. The Chai Bahem, he shall live by them." And the rabbis say, "He shall live by them and not die by them. Desecrate one Sabbath on his account, that he may keep many Sabbaths." My grandfather, Reb Chaim of Brisk, disagreed with the legal view that on Yom Kippur, one feeds a sick person who is in danger of dying small amounts of food at a time, each amount less than the forbidden measure of food for that day. Because there are shitas that say that there are shiurim. You have to give a small amount of food or a small amount of water so that the individual who is not well can eat or drink, but that he will not be breaking the laws of Yom Kippur, because the laws of Yom Kippur are extremely stringent. Says Reb Chaim Brisker, that's just absolutely ridiculous. When you're dealing with a sick person, then you throw all those considerations right out the window where they belong. Reb Chaim Soloveitchik felt he instructed those who were taking care of a sick individual to serve him a regular meal, just as they would serve that person a regular meal on any other day. And doesn't that make sense? If you're dealing with somebody who's not well, then he's not well. If somebody is well, he fasts. If somebody is not feeling well, he's very, very sick, then you toss Yom Kippur out the window and you feed him a normal amount of food so he can reclaim his health. And if he's really in a dangerous spot, then of course you do the same thing. It shouldn't matter if he's at death's door or if he's just sick. If he's the kind of person who is really sick, a sick individual, that's how he's being described over here. He's supposed to live by these commandments and not die by them. Obviously, we don't want anybody passing away. But if you've got a situation where somebody who is so ill that we're going to have to feed him, if he reaches the point where he's got to get fed on Yom Kippur, so you don't feed him an ounce of food or half an ounce of water, that's not going to help him. You toss aside the strictures of Yom Kippur and you feed him as if it were a normal day. Says Rabbi Soloveitchik, "When my father, Rav Moshe, was about to travel to Razain, a town close to Kovna, to take up a rabbinical post, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik took him aside and said, 'Moshe, I command you to follow my view regarding a sick person in danger on Yom Kippur, because it is an absolute halacha truth, and you couldn't get anybody bigger than Reb Chaim Brisker to tell you that.'" I mean, that is an incredible thing. That's the mark of a man. That's the mark of this man. He was such a chesed-oriented individual. He was so humane, cared about humanity so much. Imagine saying, "Listen, when you take over the position of rabbi of that town, if somebody is in danger on Yom Kippur, then you feed him a normal amount of food and give him a normal amount of drink. You don't worry about the laws of Yom Kippur. For that person, guess what? It's not Yom Kippur. He's in danger. He is not going to be fasting. If he fasts, he might drop dead. Then what are you going to do with him? Besides bury him, what are you going to do for him? It's ridiculous to give a guy half an ounce or an ounce, because God forbid you shouldn't break the laws of Yom Kippur. How is that supposed to help a person who is really in danger?" Says Reb Chaim Brisker, "Don't be a fool. I'm sure you would consider this a chassid shota. It's like somebody can't touch a woman if she's drowning. Oh, I can't touch her. I don't want to be touching somebody who's in need. What are you, nuts? Talking about a human life over here. Same thing. Yom Kippur, person's in danger, get in there and feed that person. Because for that person, it's not Yom Kippur anymore. Imagine those words. I command you to follow my view regarding a sick person in danger on Yom Kippur. For it is an absolute halachic truth. Amen to that. If Chaim Brisker, you're still the man. You're still the man. I follow you in a heartbeat, wherever you go. With a teaching like that, you get my vote. Bottom page 251, developing character traits. The later Rebbe Soloveitchik in his annual Yahrzeit drush in memory of his father, Rebbe Moshe Soloveitchik, delivered in 1959. My late father told me that before he left to accept his first rabbinical post in the city of Rezain, he visited his father, Reb Chaim of Brisk. Reb Chaim instructed him as follows. Like all Jews, a rabbi must be charitable and compassionate. Not only when he is a good person by nature, but even if he is naturally not like that. I myself was born with an impersonal and insensitive nature, but I worked on myself until I developed good character traits. So much so that people say that as great as he was as an intellect, and he was a phenomenon as an intellect, and some say he was up there with the greatest of all geniuses, he was also even greater in his chesed. Can you even begin to imagine how great this man was if his greatness in chesed was actually outranking his greatness in his intelligence, and his intelligence was world class? We continue. Top of page 252. The hybrid Estrig, related by Rav Soloveitchik in his Yarche Kalashir on Sukkos, delivered in Boston, 1979. A hybrid Estrig, a Merkav, a hybrid. It's got a little bit of citron, made a little bit of lemon, whatever. It's invalid. It's puzzle for the fulfillment of the mitzvah to take an Estrig on Sukkos. Why? Simply because genetically, it's not an Estrig. If it's a hybrid or a cross, it's not an Estrig. If I may interrupt, let me tell you a nice story I heard from my late father. My father's first rabbinical post was in Rezain, near Kovno. Rezain was a city filled with rabbinical scholars. My father arrived there before Rosh Hashanah as the rabbi of the city. There was a dayan in the town who disliked my father, and this dayan had not signed the Ksav Rabbanus, the rabbinical contract which had been given to my father. It was the first day of Sukkos. The custom on the first day of Yom Tov was that all the rabbinical scholars in the community would go from the shuls after the morning prayers to wish their rabbi a good Yom Tov. It seems that this was a widespread custom, since I remember the same practice from Chaslavichi. This was a fulfillment of the dictum of our sages that it is incumbent on a man to go pay his respects to his teacher on festivals. As I state in Gemara Rosh Hashanah 16b, at this time, the rabbi would also say a short Dvar Halacha, Torah thought on law, in honor of his guests. I still remember what my father used to discuss on these occasions. In Rezain, the first day of Sukkos, the people were anxious to meet the new rabbi. So everybody went to greet my father, and the dayan was among them. They sat down and enjoyed a nice tete-a-tete with my father. According to protocol, no one was supposed to ask any questions. It was simply to hear the Dvar Torah, get up, say good Yom Tov, and leave. This was evidently a custom of long standing in many Lithuanian towns. I still remember how my father would lean on his hand and say the Dvar Torah, which was not as long as my Dvar Torah. That got laughter in Boston. His Dvar Torah would take from 10 to 15 minutes at the most. They used to get up, say good Yom Tov, Rebbe, and then walk away. Anyway, the dayan came along that year and broke with protocol. This dayan had the monopoly on selling the srogim in Rezain. The custom had been introduced by great rabbinic authorities so that the dayanim would be able to support themselves without receiving remuneration for their legal decisions. Because the sages declared that, quote, the legal decisions of one who takes a fee for acting as a judge are null and void. Gemara Ksubas 105a. However, if you give the rabbi the privilege of selling a certain article, this is not considered remuneration for his rulings. If the inhabitants of the city respect this privilege, then the rabbi can support himself from the profit he earns from these sales. Anyway, the dayan who supported himself from the sale of a shrogim was present. He told my father that he had already studied the laws of the Lulav and Estrig and the Shulchan Aruch 35 times. He knew the code of the Shulchan Aruch, the emendations of the Ramah, and the commentaries of the Taz and the Magen Avraham almost by heart. Yet he had a certain problem, and maybe my father could help him. The dayan felt that this problem was not mentioned in the Shulchan Aruch. He wanted to know why a hybrid Estrig was not valid for fulfilling the precept. The catch was that he wanted to see if my father would tell him that the Magen Avraham mentioned this ruling, although the Shulchan Aruch did not. This was the catch. However, my father responded by declaring that the Shulchan Aruch also did not mention that an apple is void when utilized as an esrog. The dayan exclaimed, "An apple? Who would imagine that an apple is an esrog?" My father answered, "The same with a morkov, the same with a hybrid. It's simply not an esrog. It's no different than an apple." Bruh. Even though it's got some aspects of an esrog to it, it's no different than an apple. So you can indeed compare it to an apple. How about that? And now we're on page 255. Chaslavitchi's rabbis, related by Rabbi Soloveitchik in his eulogy for Rabbi Moshe Dober Rifkin at Congregation Moriah in New York City in December of 1976. I do not know about many branches of the Hasidic movement, but I do know about Chabad. I grew up in Chaslavitchi, which was a center of Chabad Hasidus. In my youth, I prayed in the old Beis Medrash, which was a Chabad shul. They had a tradition that the Rav, meaning the founder of Chabad Hasidism, Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, who in 1745 passed away in 1813, they had a tradition that Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Liadi twice prayed in the shul when he was fleeing from the onslaught of the Grand Army of Napoleon in 1812, accompanying the retreating Russian army. The Rav helped organize intelligence for the Russian army. Without his help, the Russians might have lost the war to the French. The Rav was reputed to have said, "If Russia wins the war, the Jews will remain poor, but at least they'll be religious. If Napoleon wins, the Jews will be rich, but they will lose their faith in the Almighty." Once it's a question of being poor or losing one's faith, Rabbi Soloveitchik ruled, it is far worse to lose one's faith. I'm sorry, the Rav over here is referring to, of course, Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Liadi. He's the Rav. Of course, they call it Shulchan Aruch HaRav. He made emendations on the Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch HaRav, and he is known as the Rav. He's known as the Balatanya in Hasidic, in Chabad circles. Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Liadi did not render this decision only in his shtiebel to his Hasidim, instead of to be poor, but to not keep your, but not lose your faith. He wants you to keep your faith, and if you have to be poor in order to do it, well, then that's the price we got to pay to keep Jews Jewish. Rabbi Shneur Zalman did not render this decision only in his shtiebel to his Hasidim. He also went about helping the Tsar's army in a concrete way. He utilized his chassid Moshe Meislish, who knew French and Russian perfectly, to spy Napoleon's army. As a result of these activities, all the members of the Schneerson family and their descendants were granted honorary Russian citizenship. This was in contrast to the masses of Jews who had the status of city dwellers but were not citizens. If not for the Meislish spy network, the French might have conquered Russia. Imagine that. Now you're going to hear some really amazing stuff. Let's continue. Chaslavitchi was a city filled with Chabad Hasidim, many of whom were truly dedicated Hasidim. Nevertheless, the rabbi of Chaslavitchi was always a misnagid, always an opponent of the Hasidic movement, a real litvak, a student of the Gaon. This was in contrast to the communities surrounding Chaslavitchi, where there were always two rabbis, one a misnagid, the other a chassid. In Chaslavitchi, all the rabbis in the last century were misnagdim, from the school of the Vilna Gaon and the Volozhiner Yeshiva. The reason for this tradition was that the spying activities of Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Liadi, the Alter Rebbe, they call him in Chabad, the first rabbi of Chabad, were known, the spying activities of Rabbi Shneur Zalman were known to the French when they surrounded the town, Chaslovichi. The French issued an order to capture the rabbi of Liadi, dead or alive. At this time, the rabbi of Chaslovichi was Rabbi Yisrael Ashkenazi of Shklov, the author of the Piyat HaShulchan and a student of the Vilna Gaon. So the Rav, meaning Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi, he hid in Rabbi Yisrael Ashkenazi's house. The French searched every home carefully. When it came to that of Rabbi Yisrael, the French knew that he was a follower of the Gaon and therefore an opponent of the Chassidim. They simply knocked on Yisrael's door and declared that they were searching for the rabbi of Liadi. Yisrael told them that he would immediately surrender any Hasidic leader to them, but he did not know where the rabbi of Liadi was. The French did not search his home, and they left. The Rav remained in Rabbi Yisrael, the Alter Rebbe, the first Lubavitcher rabbi, Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Liadi. He remained in Rabbi Yisrael's home, and after he was saved, declared that all of the future rabbis of Chaslovichi should only be misnagdim. In my eyes, this story is authentic. In my youth, I heard it from many of the older Hasidim in Chaslovichi. I learned a great deal about Chabad when I resided there.
Okay. There's a lot here.
Just a little more. Spying for the Tsarist army, related by the Rav when Rabbi Menachem Kazdan was his student. The Rav once asked, how was it that his father, a misnagdim, became the rabbi of Chaslovichi, which was essentially a shtetl of Lubavitcher Hasidim? The Rav explained that the tradition of Chaslovichi was to always have a masnagid at the door, and if possible, someone from the family of the Vilna Gaon or his students. How did this come about? When Napoleon Bonaparte invaded Russia in about 1812, there was a great controversy between the Hasidic Rebbeim as to whom they should support. Rabbi Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev supported Napoleon because the Russian Tsars were very oppressive to the Jews. Rabbi Levi Yitzchak held that anything that would lessen the yoke of the Russian government would be beneficial for the Jews. Okay. On the other hand, Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Liadi, the founder of Chabad Hasidism, held the opposite point of view. He felt that while physically it would be better for the Jews if Napoleon won, it would be disastrous on a spiritual level. A victory for Napoleon would open the gates to the spirit of assimilation, which was then engulfing Western Europe. According to Hasidic tradition, Rav Shneur Zalman won out because on Rosh Hashanah he got up earlier than Rabbi Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev to blow the shofar. Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi did not just support the Tsarist government in theory, he also took concrete steps to help. Hasidim would spy for him and check on the movements of the French army. In particular, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe utilized a Hasid named Moshe Meislich, who was fluent in many languages. Meislich would go behind French lines and then return to the Russian side and pass on the information that he had gathered to Rav Shneur Zalman. The latter would then make it available to Russian intelligence. We'll finish up with this story. The French knew of the activities of Rav Shneur Zalman. The word went out that the French wanted to capture him, dead or alive. He was pursued and died while running away. On the move, he reached the town of Chaslovichi and sought a place to hide. I'm a student of the Vilna Gaon, Rabbi Yisrael Ashkenazi from Shklov, the author of the Shulchan, who was then the rabbi of Chaslovichi. He hid the first Lubavitcher Rebbe in his home. The Hasidim who were with Rabbi Shneur Zalman were aghast when he agreed to this proposal. They were fearful that the host, who was a misnagid, an opponent of Hasidism, would turn the Rebbe in. Rav Shneur Zalman, however, felt that Rabbi Yisrael Ashkenazi was above all a good Jew and would not inform on any Jew. It is related that when the French forces came into Chaslovichi searching for the Rebbe, they did not even bother to carefully look in the house of Rabbi Yisrael Ashkenazi. After all, he was a misnagid, and they did not suspect that he would save a Hasidic Rebbe. So the Baal HaTanya was saved. This is the story that the Lubavitch Hasidim were constantly retold. As a result of this episode, it was enacted that in Chaslovichi, the rabbi should always be a misnagid, and preferably from the family or the traditions of the Vilna Gaon. That's how Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik became the rabbi of Chaslovichi. Joseph B. Soloveitchik recalled that as a child growing up in Chaslovichi, he constantly observed that opposite the Mizrach Vant, opposite the eastern wall of the synagogue, there was a good spot where nobody prayed. Tradition has it that that was the place where Rav Shneur Zalman prayed when running away from the French army, and nobody, therefore, was allowed to pray there as well. Once he sanctified the place, that's his place, and out of respect for him, nobody prayed there anymore. Okay, we're going to call a little quits over here. I got to say, I got to attend to a bunch of things. I'm a little bit tired, too. So sorry for the truncated class. With God's help, we're on page 258, and we should be able to finish this off very, very smoothly. Next week, the thing is, I'm going to be, it will be in Manhattan or something. I'll steal an hour and finish off the book. Okay, we'll have Sherry Brachas. My niece is getting married on Sunday night in Lakewood, and God willing, Sherry Brachas that next evening, Monday night, in Manhattan on the Lower East Side. So we should be able to grab an hour, hopefully from 1 to 2, and finish off the Sefer right in time for Shavuot. It's a very, very nice, auspicious occasion indeed. Wishing everybody a very, very good day, healthy day, happy and productive day. Please join us tomorrow night for Tanakh Tuesday as we continue our study of 2 Kings chapter 17. Take care and be well. Thank you all, one and all. Take care and be well. Bye-bye now.